Chapter 9. The surgeon's cabin in HMS Surprise would have been a dark, cramped triangle like a slice of cake, if its sharp end hadn't been cut off, which made it into a dark, cramped quadrilateral. It was so low that a moderately tall man would have struck his head on the deck above if he'd stood upright, and it didn't possess a single right angle in its entire construction. But Dr. Maturin was rather short, and although he was reasonably fond of right angles, he was fonder still of a place that didn't have to be stripped bare every time the ship cleared for action, as the Surprise did every evening, a place where his books and specimens could remain undisturbed. As for the want of room, long use and his friend the carpenter's ingenuity in the matter of folding cot and table and of lockers built in unlikely places dealt with that to some degree. And as for the darkness, Stephen had devoted a very small fraction of his preposterous winnings, the winnings he'd actually received in elegant Bank of England notes, to the lining of all free surfaces with sheets of best Venetian looking-glass, which increased the light that filtered down to such an extent that it allowed him to read and write without a candle. He was writing now, and to his wife, his feet wedged against one stanchion and the back of his chair against another, for the frigate was behaving in a very skittish manner as she beat up against a short head sea. The letter had begun the day before, when the Surprise, steering for Santa Maura, where two ships of her convoy were to be left, had been forced away by stress of weather, forced away almost to Ithaca. To Ithaca itself, upon my word of honour. But would any amount of pleading on my part, or on the part of all the literate members of the ship's company, induce that animal to bear away for the sacred spot? It would not. Certainly he'd heard of Homer, and had indeed looked into Mr. Pope's version of his tale, but for aught he could make out, the fellow was no seaman. Admittedly, Ulysses had no chronometer, and probably no sextant neither, but with no more than log, lead, and lookout, an officer like Commander would have found his way home from Troy a damn sight quicker than that. Hanging about in port and philandering, that was what it amounted to, the vice of navies from the time of Noah to that of Nelson. And as for that tale of all his foremast hands being turned into swine, so that he couldn't win his anchor or make sail, why, he might tell that to the marines. Besides, he behaved like a very mere scrub to Queen Dido. Though on second thought, perhaps, that was the other cove, the pious Anchises. But it was all one. They were six of one and half a dozen of the other, neither seamen nor gentlemen, and both of them goddamn bores into the bargain. For his part, he far preferred what Mowat and Rowan wrote. That was poetry a man could get his teeth into, and it was sound seamanship too. In any case, he was here to conduct his convoy into Santa Maura, not to gape at curiosities. Then, feeling that he was exposing his friend rather too much, for the animal in question was, of course, the captain of the Surprise, he laid the sheet aside and wrote, "Jack Aubrey has faults and despair, the dear knows. He thinks a sailor's highest aim is to carry his ship from A to B in the shortest possible time, losing not a minute, so that life is a kind of perpetually harassing race. That only yesterday he was doggedly, mechanically stubborn in his refusal to turn a little way aside so that we might view Ithaca. Yet, on the other hand, and this is my real point, he is capable of a most surprising degree of magnanimity and self-command when the occasion calls for it. A much higher degree than you might suppose from his impatience over trifles. Of this I had an instance the day after we left Valletta. Among other passengers, we are carrying a Major Pollock, and at dinner this gentleman happened to observe that his brother, a lieutenant in the Navy, was amazingly proud of his new ship, the Blackwater, and that he made no doubt but she should prove a match for any of the heavy Americans. "Are you sure he said the Blackwater, sir?" asked Jack, surprised, as well he might be. since, as you know, he's been promised the vessel ever since its keel was laid down, and has wholly relied upon taking it to the North American station as soon as this short spell in the Mediterranean was over. "Quite sure, sir," replies the soldier. "I had a letter from him with the last mail that came in the very morning I came aboard. It was dated from the Blackwater in the Cove of Cork. And he said he hoped to be in Nova Scotia before it reached me, since there was a fine nor'easter blowing, and Captain Irby was a great one for cracking on." "Then let's drink to his health," says Jack, "the Blackwater and all who sail in her." In the evening, when we were alone in the great cabin and I made some allusion to the broken promise, all he said was, "Yes, it's a damned heavy blow, but whining don't help. Let's get on with our music." And it was indeed a very heavy blow. And when Jack woke in the morning and the recollection came flooding into his mind, the brilliant day darkened. He'd counted upon the Blackwater with absolute certainty. He'd counted upon continuing employment at sea, a matter of the first importance to him now that his affairs on shore were in such a lamentable state. And not only that, he'd relied upon being able to take his officers and his followers with him, and with luck almost the whole of the Surprise's crew. Now all this was at an end. The whole efficient, smoothly working organization, all the makings of a happy ship and a deadly fighting machine, must be dispersed. And in all likelihood he must be thrown on the beach. Furthermore, since Mr. Croker, the First Secretary, had used him badly, even dishonourably, he would almost certainly look upon the name of Aubrey with disfavour in the future. A very heavy blow indeed. But few would have guessed it, watching him tell Major Pollock how the Surprise and her allies had turned the French out of Margaux when last she was in these waters. The frigate, with the remaining convoy under her lee, a well-behaved convoy, keeping exactly to station in these dangerous waters, had stood well in to the southern side of Cape Stavro, a great headland that jutted far out into the Ionian Sea. And now they were abreast of the walled town, nestling at the foot of its tall cliffs and straggling some way up them in rock-hewn terraces. "There's this citadel, you see," he said, pointing over the pale green, white-flecked sea, "to the right of the green domed church and above it. And down by the mole there are the two tiers of batteries that guard the entrance to the harbour." The soldier gave Marga a long, knowing look through the telescope. "I should have thought it was perfectly impregnable from the sea," he said at last. "Those flanking batteries alone would surely sink a fleet." "That was my impression," said Jack. "So we set about it another way. If you follow the line of the wall behind the citadel, you'll see a square tower about a quarter of the way up the cliff." "I have it. And behind that, a round masonry affair, like a prodigious great field drain." "Yes. That's their aqueduct. They have no water of their own. And it comes from springs above Koutali, some 2 or 3 miles away on the other side of the cape. On the brow of the hill, you can just make out something of the road, or rather path that covers the water channel before it plunges down the pipe. That's where we placed our guns." "Is the other side of the cape as steep too as this?" "More so, if anything." "Then it must have been a most enormous undertaking getting a gun up there. You made a road, I presume?" "No, a ropeway. We winched them up by 2 stages to the path of the aqueduct, and once they were there, we could trundle them along without too much difficulty, particularly as we had 600 Albanians and a great number of Turks to tally onto the tow ropes. When we had a reasonable battery up there, we fired a few sighting shots into the harbour and sent down to tell the French commanding officer that if he didn't surrender directly, we should be under the painful necessity of destroying the town." "Did you offer them any terms?" "No. and I particularly desired that no counter-proposals or conditions should be put forward, our superiority being so great that they couldn't possibly be entertained. To be sure, plunging fire from such a height would have been perfectly murderous, and he could have made no reply. He couldn't scale the cliffs to come at us either. There's only one shepherd's path, like the one in Gibraltar, that leads up from Catalan Bay, and my Turkish ally, Skiahan Bey, had sharpshooters covering every turn of it. But even so, I was surprised when the surrender came back straight away. I wonder he didn't make at least some show of resistance, or wait until a few houses had been knocked down, as the usual thing, after all. It would perhaps have been a little more decent, and it would certainly have looked better at his court-martial. But then we learnt that his wife was having a baby, and the doctors were very anxious for her. Gunfire and falling houses, not at all the thing. So he preferred not to make a mere noisy demonstration that must come to the same thing in the end. No doubt it was quite a reasonable decision, said Major Pollock in a dissatisfied tone. Lord, said Jack Aubrey, casting his mind back, I've never seen anyone so disappointed as my Albanians. They sweated like galley slaves getting the guns up. For when we'd hoisted them to the top of the ropeway, they still had to travel along the covering of the aqueduct, and that called for hundreds of 4-inch planks from the shipyards perpetually shifted to spread the weight, as well as strong teams for pulling. They'd carried round shot like heroes and any amount of powder, and they'd covered themselves with weapons of one kind or another, and now they were going to have to take everything back again without a single shot fired in anger. They very nearly set about the Turks, so as not to be done out of a fight altogether. And my Pope, they have any number of popes in these parts, you know, and the Bey had to lay about them roaring like bulls in a basin. However, it all ended happy. We packed the Frenchman off to Zante, bag and baggage, and then the Margiots gave us a feast that lasted from noon till dawn the next day, Christians in one piazza, Muslims in the next, with plenty of kind words passing between, and songs and dances whenever we could eat no more for the time being. He remembered the arcade between the piazzas, the swaying line of tall Albanians in white kilts, their arms linked at shoulder height and their feet moving in perfect rhythm, the flare of torches and the warm night, the strong singing and its insistent beat, the taste of resiny wine. "Do you mean to put in there now, sir?" asked Major Pollock. "Oh, no," said Jack. "We're bound for Kutali on the far side of the Cape. And if only that infernal slug," glancing at the Tortoise storeship, the heaviest sailor in the convoy, "don't miss stays again, we shall round the point on this tack and so run in before nightfall. And then you'll be able to see the other end of the story. Mr. Mowat, I believe we may throw out the signal and prepare to go about ourselves. But give the poor tortoise plenty of time. We may be old and fat ourselves one day." The tortoise, given ample warning, came round nobly, cheered by one and all, and the convoy steered steadily for the far point of Cape Stavros, weathering it with half a mile to spare at about the time that Captain Aubrey was finishing his solitary dinner. Until his finances grew so very uncertain, Jack had kept a table in the traditional way, nearly always inviting two or three officers and a midshipman. And even now he still entertained a good deal. Apart from anything else, he felt that it was part of his duty to make sure that in the squalor of the midshipman's berth, his young gentleman didn't forget how to eat like human beings. But he did so more often at breakfast, which called for less preparation on all hands. Yet since learning of their ship's fate, he'd felt a reluctance to ask anyone. They were so cheerful, all except the melancholy Gill, and he felt so false concealing the knowledge that would make their days almost as dark as his own. He was eating his dinner not in the dining room, but right aft, sitting with his face to the great stern window, so that on the far side of the glass, and a biscuit toss below, the frigate's wake streamed away and away from him, dead white in the troubled green, so white that the gulls, poising and swooping over it, looked quite dingy. This was a sight that never failed to move him. the noble curve of shining panes, wholly unlike any land-born window. And then the sea, in some one of its infinity of aspects, and the whole in silence, entirely to himself. If he spent the rest of his life on half pay in a debtor's prison, he would still have had this, he reflected, eating the last of the Kefalonian cheese. And it was something over and above any reward he could possibly have contracted for. In the lowest starboard pane appeared the tip of Cape Stavros, a grey limestone cliff 700 feet high with the remains of an archaic temple on it, one column standing yet. Slowly the cape invaded pane after pane, rising and falling with the swell. A file of Dalmatian pelicans flew across, vanishing to larboard. And just at the moment Jack would have raised his voice, he heard Rowan's cry, "Hands about ship!" And immediately afterwards the sharp cutting notes and prolonged howl of the boatswain's call. But this was followed by no rush of feet, indeed by no sound at all. Since the Surprises had been expecting the manoeuvre these last 5 minutes, they had put their barkie about thousands of times, often in pitch darkness with an ugly sea running, and it was hardly to be expected that they should now rush flat-footed up and down like a parcel of grass-combing landsmen. Indeed, the subsequent orders were little more than a matter of form. "Off tack and sheets," called Rowan, and Jack felt the beginning of the swing. "Then mainsail haul!" The pelicans and the cape moved steadily back across the window. The Surprise was head to wind, and they were certainly getting the main tack down and the sheet hauled in. "Let go and haul!" cried Rowan in a perfunctory voice, and the impetus of the turn increased. The cayenne wine in Jack's glass took on a centrifugal lean, quite independent of the lift of the sea, until the ship steadied on her new course, and Rowan's voice could be heard again crying, "Davies, do for God's sake leave the damn thing alone!" Since every time the Surprise came about and braced her yards sharp up, Davies would give her foretopsail bowline an extra swig off for what he considered smartness. And being a horribly powerful man with poor coordination, he would sometimes pluck the bridle bodily out of the kringles.
"Kill it," called Jack. "Is there any more of the Santa Maura cake left?"
"No, there ain't,"
said Killick from within. His mouth was obviously full, but this didn't disguise his ill-natured triumph. When the captain ate in the great cabin, his steward had to carry the dishes several yards farther in either direction, which angered him.
"Sir,"
he added, swallowing.
"Never mind," said Jack. "Bring the coffee." Then, after some minutes, "Bear up, Bob, man."
"Which arm coming in, oi?"
cried Killick, bringing in the tray, bent as though he were labouring over a very great distance, a limitless desert. "Is the Hubble Bubble ready in case the Turkish officers come aboard?" asked Jack, pouring himself a cup.
"Ready, oi, ready, sir,"
said Killick, who had been smoking it off and on most of the morning with Lewis, the captain's cook.
"But I thought it my duty to run it in, like, and the tobacco's rather low. Shall I take some more?"
Jack nodded. "And what about the cushions?"
"Never you fret, sir. I stripped the gunroom's cots and sails is at work on them. Cushions is ready, and so is the conversation peppermints."
These were to be had in Malta. They were extraordinarily popular in the eastern Mediterranean, and many an awkward pause had they filled in Greek, Balkan, Turkish and Levantine ports.
"That's a comfort. Well, now, in 5 minutes' time, I should like to see Mr. Honey and Mr. Maitland."
These were the senior members of his meagre midshipman's berth. They'd been rated master's mates for some considerable time now, and they were quite capable of taking a watch. Pleasant, seamanlike young fellows, neither of them a phoenix, but both good, average officers in the making, but The making, that was the trouble. To be made, a young man had first to pass for lieutenant, and then somebody or something had to induce the Admiralty to give him a lieutenant's commission and appoint him to a ship. For without that he might remain a past midshipman for the rest of his naval life. Jack had known many a young gentleman of 40 and more. He was unlikely to be able to do much about the second stage, but nothing whatsoever could be done until they passed the first, and he could at least help them through that. "Come in," he said, swinging round. "Come in and sit down." Neither was aware of any really heinous crime, but neither meant to tempt fate by rash confidence, and they sat meekly with cautious, respectful expressions. "I've been looking at the master," went on Jack, "and I find that both of you are pretty well out of your servitude."
"Yes, sir," said Maitland. "I've served my full 6 years, all of it genuine sea time, sir, and Honey only lacks 2 weeks."
"Just so," said Jack. "And it seems to me that you might be well advised to try to pass for lieutenant as soon as we get back to Malta. Two of the sitting captains will be friends of mine, and although I don't mean that they'll show you any improper favour, at least they'll not savage you, which is a great thing if you're anxious. And most people are anxious when they're examined. I know I was. If you wait until you're in London, you'll find it a far more awe-inspiring affair. In my day, it was the only place. You had to go to the Navy office to pass, even if it meant waiting for years and years until you could get back from Sumatra or the Coromandel coast." Once again he saw the stony magnificence of Somerset House on that first Wednesday in the month. The vast round hall with 30 or 40 long-legged gawky youths clutching their certificates, each with a troop of relatives, sometimes very imposing, nearly always hostile towards the other candidates. The porter calling their names two by two. The climbing of the stairs, one being admitted while the other waited by the white circular railings, straining his ears to hear the questions. The tears on the face of the boy who came out as he went in. "Whereas here, you see, it's more of a family affair."
"Yes, sir," they said.
"I'm not afraid of their failing you in seamanship," he went on. "No, it's navigation that may lay you both by the lee. Now these," he said, picking up the young gentleman's workings, the papers that both oldsters and youngsters were required to hand to the marine sentry at the cabin door every day as soon as they'd fixed the ship's noon position, "these are all very well, and it so happens that they're reasonably accurate. But they're worked out by rule of thumb, and I'm afraid that if you were asked any fine points of theory, and examining captains are doing so more and more nowadays, you would be all to seek. Honey, suppose you know the ship's leeway and her rate of sailing by the log, how do you find the angle of correction to lay off the course she's made good?" Honey looked aghast, and said he believed he could find it out, sir, if he were allowed paper and time. Maitland thought he might do the same. The rule was in Nori. "I dare say you could," said Jack, "but the whole point is that if you come up against a Tartar, you're not allowed to look into Nori, nor are you given time or paper. You have to sing out straight away that as the ship's rate is to the sine of the angle of leeway, so the leeway is to the sine of the angle of correction. Now, I don't suppose that we shall have a great deal to do this run, so if you like to come here in the afternoons, we'll try to polish your navigation in its finer points." When they'd gone, he noted down some particularly knotty points to do with oblique and right ascension, points that had arisen when he was talking to Sextant Dudley, a scientific captain who despised mere seamen and who might easily appear on the examining board together with Jack's closer friends. And then he went on deck. The Surprise was already halfway down Kutali Bay, wafting along to the windward of her convoy like a superlatively elegant swan, with a band of common and, in some cases, rather dirty goslings. All her passengers were gazing at the scene. And although he knew it so well, Jack caught some of his first astonishment in their admiration. Vast sweep of the bay, filled with small craft and trabacolos. The prodigious shoreline of mountains plunging straight into deep water. The close-packed fortified town rising from the harbour at an angle of 45 degrees and shining in the sun. Pink roofs, white walls, light grey ramparts, green copper domes. And beyond it, higher mountains still, their sides, sometimes bare, sometimes dark with forest, and their peaks tangled in the thin, vaporous white clouds.
"Now, sir," he said to Major Pollock, "now you can see where we began. At the corner of the mole over there, we set up an extraordinarily massive double holdfast and ran a line straight up over the lower ramparts, over the middle town, and so to the citadel itself. We bounced it, as taut as a fiddle string, and with props clapped on just before and just after the passage of the most delicate places, the guns ran up as sweetly as kiss your hand. That was the first stage. The second I cannot show you very clearly from here because of the dead ground behind the castle crag, but there, where it rises again on the swelling green below those light-coloured bluffs, you see, you can make out the line of the buried aqueduct following the contour. Though, now I come to think about it, perhaps, first of all, I should give you some notion of the political side. It was tolerably complex. "I beg your pardon, sir," said Mowat, "but I believe the bay has put off." "Damn me, so soon," said Jack, taking his telescope. "You're quite right, though. And there's that dear Pope with him. Begin the salute." "These were my allies in this affair," he said to Pollock as the gunner came hurrying aft with his salamander. "And I believe I shall have to break off for a while, particularly as I see half a dozen other boats getting ready to follow them." The surprise's salute hadn't finished before the Turks began blazing away from a battery a little to the south of the lower town. They'd done very well out of the French artillery and Marga, both in guns and ammunition. And in their cheerful Turkish way, they sent the occasional round shots skipping across the water among the fishing boats. Within minutes, the Christians in the citadel, who had done rather better, joined in with their 12-pounders. Heavy smoke drifted across Kutali from below and from above. The mountains sent the echoes to and fro across the bay, and in the intervals the sharper crack of muskets, pistols and fowling pieces could be heard. The surprise was a most uncommonly popular ship among the Kutaliots, she having preserved them from two rapacious, tyrannical beys, and having provided them with the means of preserving what, in fact, amounted to their independence. She'd not done so out of disinterested benevolence. It arose from her campaign against the French, but the result was much the same, and so was the goodwill. The virtual rulers of the little state came beaming up the side to the full ceremonial welcome of bosun's calls, marines presenting arms, bare-headed officers in their best coats, the ruffle of the drum. And Skiahan Bey, a short, broad-shouldered, scarred and grizzled Turkish warrior, skipped over to Jack with his arms spread wide and kissed him on both cheeks, immediately followed by Father Andros, which so pleased the surprises that they uttered a discreet but universal cheer. "Where is the Pullings?" asked Father Andros in Italian, looking about. For a moment Jack couldn't recall the Italian for being made a commander, so he made a dart at the Greek. "Promotides," he said, pointing upwards. But seeing that they looked shocked and grieved, and that the priest crossed himself in the orthodox manner, he tapped his epaulettes, crying, "No, no, him Capitano, par morto, elevato in grado." And raising his voice, "Dr. Maturin, pass the word for the doctor." In the pause, the priest called down into the boat for a petrified little girl who stood in the bows, not daring to sit, starched, frizzled and powdered almost out of humanity, carrying a bunch of roses as large as herself. It was something of a task getting her aboard, since she passionately resisted any motion at parting her from the flowers, or any that might ruffle her stiff crimson dress, but it was accomplished at last. And with her eyes fixed on Father Andros, she went through her address to Jack, reluctantly yielding her bouquet at the end. While this was going on, the surprise had come to an anchor, and the clewing up of the main topsail revealed Dr. Maturin at the crosstrees, an extraordinarily elevated post for him. Much of the afternoon he'd spent sitting in the broad, comfortable platform of the main top in the hope of seeing a spotted eagle, one of the great prizes of this coast, and his patience had been rewarded with no less than two, playing together and flying so low that he could almost look into their eyes. But the topsail kept shutting out his view, and with the combined energy of frustration and delight, he swarmed slowly up to this bold eminence, his gaze constantly turned towards the sky. There, in the cross-trees, he had indeed had a glorious sight of the birds. But they'd vanished long ago, circling up and up into the sky, until at last they were lost among the wispy clouds. And since then, he'd been horribly puzzled to get down again. The more he contemplated the void below, the more impossible it seemed that he should ever have reached these vile cross-trees. And the more convulsively he grasped the heel of the t'gallant mast in any rope that offered. He was aware that if he instantly and with a firm manly resolution let himself dangle, perhaps with eyes closed, then his questing feet would most probably find a hold. But this awareness did him little practical good. It led to no decisive action, only to endless reflections upon the imbecility of human will and the true nature of vertigo. Jack, following his lieutenant's significant look at the close of the ceremony with the flowers, seized the position at once. He kissed the little girl, passed the bouquet to his coxswain, and said, "Bondon, lay aloft. Make these fast to the main truck, and on your way down, show the doctor the most convenient way of reaching the deck. My compliments, and shall be glad to see him in the cabin." By the time Stephen reached the deck, it was covered with smiling, gift-bearing cotaliots of one kind and another, Catholic, Orthodox, Muslim, Jew, Armenian, Copt, and more were coming in little boats. And by the time he reached the cabin, it was deep in the fragrant smoke of Kefalonian tobacco. The hookah was bubbling away in the middle, and Captain Aubrey, Father Andros, and Skihan Bey were sitting about it on cushions, or, to be more exact, on all the surprises pillows hastily covered with flags, drinking coffee out of Wedgwood cups. They welcomed him cordially, even affectionately, and gave him an amber mouthpiece to smoke with. "Fallen wonderfully lucky," said Jack. "If I don't mistake, the Bay's people have found a monstrous fine bear, and we're going to hunt him tomorrow." "He was a monstrous fine bear indeed, my dear," wrote Captain Aubrey in a letter dated Surprise off Trieste. "And if only we'd been a little braver, you should have had his skin. He stood at bay, with his back to a rock, rearing up 7 or 8 feet tall, eyes flashing, red mouth foaming, hair on end, looking very like Admiral Duncan, and we could have shot him through and through. But no, no," cried Stephen. "A bear's a gentleman and must be dispatched with a spear." "Very true," he said, and begged him to show us how. "Not at all," said he. He was concerned only with seeing that the bear was not abused. The honour of killing him obviously belonged to a man of war, not to one of peace. This we could scarcely deny, but the question was, which man of war? "I thought the Bey should certainly have the precedence, being of higher rank." He said that was great nonsense. Common good manners required him to give way to a stranger. While we were arguing the toss, the bear dropped down on all fours and walked quietly into a little bushy dell beside the rock, a most devilishly awkward place to tackle him in. Finally, some meddling fellow suggested that both Skihan and I should set about him together. We couldn't very well refuse, but I assure you we took our time about creeping in among those infernal bushes, crouching and grasping our spears and glaring into the deep shadows and expecting the brute to charge any second. He was as massive as a cart horse, though lower on his pins. The only dogs left alive by this time were the cautious ones that kept well behind us, and we'd them taken up in case their silly din prevented us from hearing the bear. And so we minced along, listening with all our ears, and I've never been so frightened in all my life. Then there was Stephen screeching out, "Gone away," and hallooing and waving his hat, and there was the bear, a quarter of a mile off, going straight up the mountainside like a vast great hare. There we were, obliged to leave him, I'm afraid, since I had to get back to the ship. But, Lord, sweetheart, how that day, with even a very indifferent pack of hounds, did lift my heart. So did a trifle of action the next night when we were becalmed off Corfu, and the very enterprising Frenchman in command of the island, General Donzelot, sent out a number of boats trying to snap up one or two of the convoy. They didn't succeed, and no one was seriously hurt. But we had a lively night of it, and in her agitation one of the merchantmen fell foul of us when a breeze got up, carrying away our jib-boom. So we're quite glad to have reached the comparative peace of these waters, where there are plenty of our friends to protect us. 3 frigates and at least 4 sloops or brigs. We've only just arrived, and I haven't seen them all yet. Harvey, the senior naval officer, is looking into Venice until tomorrow, but Babington's here in the Dryad, and he sent to ask me to dinner even before we dropped our anchor. So is young Host. He's done wonders. A very active officer, and I wish I could like him better. Yet there is something of Sidney Smith about him, something a trifle self-congratulatory and theatrical. And then he does burn a shocking number of small prizes, which does him no good and the French no harm, but which does ruin the poor unfortunate men that own and sail them. This is strictly between ourselves, my dear, not to be repeated to anyone. Henry Cotton's here, too, in the Nymph. He was on shore when we arrived, but his surgeon came over. You remember him, I'm sure, Mr. Thomas, the talkative gentleman that called on Stephen when he was staying with us, to beg that Dr. Maturin would lend a hand in some particularly delicate operation. And he told me that there is now an overland post by way of Vienna that's fairly sure to get through, at least for the moment. The position in these parts is very confused. The local French commanders are able, energetic, resourceful men, and sometimes I feel that our allies... But perhaps I'd better leave that subject alone. Indeed, sweetheart, I must leave my letter alone, too, for I've just heard Harry Cotton's barge come alongside, his hoarse old coxswain wheezing out, "Nymph, nymph," like an asthmatic grampus. Aboard the Nymph herself, Dr. Maturin leant over his patient's yellow, glistening, horror-filled face and said, "There, it's all over now. With the blessing, you'll do very well." And to the man's messmates, almost as wan and horrified as their friend, "You may untie him now. You may cast him off." "Thank you, sir," said the patient in a whisper, as Stephen took the piece of padded leather from between his back teeth. "Thank you very kindly for your pains." "I've read your description of the operation, of course," said the surgeon of the Cerberus, "but I hadn't expected such dispatch. It might have been an act of legerdemain. "I admire your courage, sir," said the surgeon of the Red Wing. "Come, gentlemen," said Mr. Thomas, "I think we've all earned a little refreshment." They all walked off into the empty gun room, where Mr. Thomas treated them to a bottle of Tokay. "My next case," he said, after they gossiped for a while about Malta and the Toulon blockade, "is a perfectly commonplace wandering ball. A pistol ball received some years ago, and now causing a certain amount of pain as the result of recent physical exertion. It's lodged just at the external edge of the levator anguli scapulae, and it presents no particular interest to the philosophical surgeon, but for the fact that it is lodged in a most romantic frame."
"Indeed,"
said Stephen, seeing that some remark was called for, and that neither of the others felt inclined to make it. "Yes, sir," said Thomas with great satisfaction. "Perhaps you'll allow me to begin at the beginning?" This seemed a reasonable request, but his friends, who knew Mr. Thomas, who'd heard it all before, and who had seen Dr. Maturin perform his suprapubic cystotomy, drank up their Tokai and took their leave, and even Maturin gave only the faintest smirk of assent. Well, now, some time ago we were off Pola, steering southwest with a light breeze at north or thereabouts, very early in the morning, or perhaps I should say late at night, before the idlers had been called in any case. And in passing I may observe that it is tolerably whimsical to speak of them as idlers, more whimsical, if anything, than calling the master, purser and surgeon non-combatants. Though I'm sure that when I was surgeon's mate in the old Andromeda, or assistant surgeon, as we say nowadays, and indeed it is far more proper, mate having a certain colloquial familiar connotation, by no means suitable for a member of a learned profession, I'm sure I went away in cutting out expeditions or in sweeps along the coast in the yawl twice. I had command of the yawl, or in the barge more often than the great majority of line-of-battleship mids. But, as I was saying, or at all events intended to say, this hour between night and day is the very best time, so long as there is no great wind. For, believe me, anything more than a gallantsail breeze will infallibly put them down. The very best time for catching those fish they call scombri in these parts, which I take to be close kin to our mackerel, though they eat far more delicate. And there I was, with my wand over the taffrail, fishing along the side of the wake with a piece of bacon rind cut in the shape of a sand eel. Some say they can be catched in greater numbers with red flannel, but I swear by my bacon rind. "Mark you," he said, raising one finger, "it must be well soaked. But once it's spent 24 hours in the steep tub, once it's really pliable, there's nothing to touch your lithe, white, unctuous rind for enticing the big fellas. So, there I was, with the Lieutenant of Marines beside me, in full expectation of catching the gunroom's breakfast. Simple broiling on a piping hot, well-oiled gridiron is best, I assure you. Elaborate sauces and Persian apparatus take away their true flavour. But, however, before I'd had so much as a single bite, Norton cried out, 'Hold!' Or perhaps, 'Hush!' Something to that effect. Norton, I should have said, was the marine, William Norton, of a Westmoreland family, related to the Collingwoods. 'Listen,' he says, 'ain't that musketry?' Musketry it was. And after an exact account of what the officer of the watch said, his initial scepticism and growing conviction, and how the nymph was put about, Mr. Thomas very slowly brought the sun up over the eastern horizon to reveal a huario that had evidently just captured the small skiff it was now taking in tow. The frigate at once gave chase, and with all the more zeal because the increasing light showed French uniforms aboard the Huario. But pretty soon it appeared that the chase, which could sail closer to the wind than the square-rigged nymph, would weather Cape Promontory, whereas the frigate would not. In short, that the Huario would escape. Here, Mr. Thomas branched off to considerations to do with sailing. The fore and aft rig as opposed to the square, various combinations that might with advantage be tried, the true force of windmills, how measured by a friend of his, and Stephen's attention wandered until he heard the words, but to cut a long story short, down came her foresail when she was within a cable's length of the point. She flew up into the wind directly, of course, and there was a fella bounding about the deck like a jack-in-the-box, knocking people down right and left. The very last moments I didn't see, because the captain called out to me with that unnecessary illiberal vehemence so many sailors affect, desiring me to take my tackle out of the way. Parenthetically, I may say that I gave him such a dose, such a comfortable dose the next day when he was to take physic, I didn't scruple to add two scruples of colocynth to his black draught. Colocynth forever and the strong watery gripes. Aren't you amused, my dear sir? Very much amused, colleague. But I was on deck again by the time we were lying to, and our boat was coming back from the captured Huario, and there he was, laughing all over his face and waving to his friends as they stood there lining the rail and cheering.
To whom do you refer, colleague?
Why, to the jack-in-the-box, of course. He was laughing all over his face because he'd escaped from the French, and he was waving to his friends on the quarter-deck because he'd served in this very ship before he was captured. He'd once been third lieutenant of the Nymph, and there were still many people aboard who'd been shipmates with him. That was what was so romantic, don't you see? He escaped from the French, rowed out to sea in a little boat, hoping to find the English frigate he'd heard was cruising off the Cape, was taken by an enemy patrol when he could actually see our topsails against the sky, and then, when he was saved at the last moment, he found that his rescuer was his very own ship, or had been. I should have said it was he who cut the Huario's halyard, bringing down a foresail with a run. Rescued by his very own ship! Well, if that ain't romantic, I don't know what romance is.
Sure, Beavis of Hampton is nothing to him. And this is the gentleman we're to operate upon. I'm glad of it.
I've always found that a man in high spirits heals quicker than another, and although this wandering ball doesn't sound the gravest of interventions, it's as well to have all the chances on our side.
Yes, to be sure, said Thomas doubtfully, and perhaps I should have operated earlier when he was so cheerful, but these last days he's been very low, a deep, surly melancholy, like to hang himself, because some busy fool acquainted with Valletta gossip like the rest of us saw fit to tell him he was a...
Thomas paused and gave Stephen a meaning look.
To tell him his wife had not been quite discreet. You know what I mean. And with whom? But I hope this little bloodletting may bring resignation with it. After all, the same misfortune's befallen many another man, and most survive it.
Thomas's meaning eluded Stephen, a fact that left him perfectly indifferent. He said, "Have you prepared him at all?"
"Yes, 3 drachms of mandragora on an empty stomach."
"Mandragora?" began Stephen with some contempt, but a marine servant coming in cut him short.
"Mr. Fielding's compliments," said the marine, "and why bet he to be cut? Says he's been waiting in the sick bay his last glass and more."
"Tell him we shall be there directly," said Mr. Thomas. "What have you against mandragora, colleague?"
"Nothing at all," said Stephen.
"Is it Mr. Charles Fielding that you've been speaking of? Lieutenant Charles Fielding of the Navy?"
"Why, yes, I have said so, don't you recall? Charles Fielding, the husband of the lady with the dog that's so fond of Captain Aubrey."
"So you'd not smoked it? You hadn't gathered my meaning? How droll!"
"Shh! Not a word."
They walked into the sick bay, and there, standing in the strong light from the grating overhead and looking out of the scuttle, was a tall, dark, heavy man who might have stepped straight from the picture in Laura's bedroom. He was even wearing the same striped pantaloons. Mr. Thomas made the usual introductions, and Fielding replied with a civil, "How do you do, sir?" and a bow. But it was clear that he paid no real attention. It was clear, too, that either Mr. Thomas's mandragora or his own rum had had a considerable effect. His voice was thick and his words somewhat confused. Stephen had never known any man come cheerfully to the surgeon's table, chest or chair. Even the bravest recoiled from the deliberate incision suffered in cold blood, and most sailors added what they could to the official dose. Yet Mr. Fielding hadn't run to extremes, as did many patients who had the means. He was completely master of himself. And when he'd taken off his shirt, he submitted to having his arms tied. For was you to make a sudden, involuntary start, we might plunge a knife into an artery or sever an important nerve with a good grace. And sat there looking set and dogged, his jaw clenched tight.
The ball was deeper than Thomas had supposed. and although while they worked on his back, Fielding uttered no more than a grunt or two, by the time it was out he was breathing deep and sweating profusely. When they'd sewn him up and released his arms, Thomas looked into his face and said, "You must stay here quietly for a while. I'll send the loblolly boy to sit with you." "I should be happy to sit with Mr. Fielding," said Stephen. "When he's recovered, I should very much like to hear of his escape from the French." Coffee, hot and strong, recovered Mr. Fielding fairly soon. After the second cup, he reached over to his coat, took a slice of cold plum duff from the pocket, and devoured it out of hand. "I beg your pardon," he said, "but I've been so hungry these last months that I have to keep a bite about me." Then, raising his voice for the loblolly boy, he told him to bring the case bottle from his cabin. The loblolly boy was an aged authoritarian creature of great medical standing on the lower deck, and since spirits were forbidden in the sick bay, he hesitated, looking at Stephen. But Fielding's dark face instantly took on a still darker, extremely dangerous expression, and his voice the ring of a hard, horse-driving lieutenant, the kind whose blow might follow an order in a split second. He was clearly a man of very strong passions. The case bottle appeared, and having offered it to Stephen, Fielding swallowed first one stiff tot and then another. "That must be all for the present," said Stephen, taking it away. "We cannot afford any further loss of blood. You're very much reduced. Yours was a long and very trying journey, I have no doubt." "As a straightforward ride, it wouldn't have amounted to any very great distance," said Fielding. "I dare say a courier might do it in less than a week. But as we travelled, hiding by day and creeping along by night, generally through by-lanes or over wild country and often losing our way, it took well over 2 months. 76 days, to be exact." He spoke without much interest and broke off as though he were not going to continue. They sat in silence for some minutes, the frigate rocking gently, and the reflection of the sunlit sea shimmering on the deckhead. 2.5 months, thought Stephen. That almost exactly coincided with the first of the letters that had made Laura so uneasy, the first of the forged letters. "But as for hardships," said Fielding at length, "yes, it was a trying journey. Rarely anything to eat but what we could poach or steal, and not even that in the high mountains. And then the wet and the cold. Wilson died when we had a 2 days' snowstorm in the Trentino, and Corby's foot was so frostbitten that he could only hobble after that. I was lucky, I suppose. If it's not disagreeable to you, I should very much like to hear even the shortest account of your escape," said Stephen. "Very well," said Fielding. He had been in the penal fortress of Beach, he said, a place reserved for unruly prisoners of war, or those who had tried to escape from Verdun, and most of the time he'd been in solitary confinement because during his attempt he'd killed a gendarme. But a fire in part of the castle and the subsequent repairs had brought him into the same cell as Wilson and Corby. And since this was a time of considerable disorganization, the commander of the fortress had just been replaced, they decided to try again. In their earlier attempts, they had all three separately tried to reach the Channel or the North Sea ports. And now they meant to go the other way, eastwards for Austria and so to the Adriatic. It had to be done quickly while the workmen and their materials were still in the castle. And Corby, who was the most senior, a natural leader and a man fluent in German, abandoned the usual caution and told many of the other officers that the three of them were going to escape. Some were very helpful indeed, providing sketch maps, a pocket spyglass, a fairly accurate compass, a little money, and above all pieces of cloth or line to add to their own. While the other prisoners created a disturbance in the inner bailey late one threatening evening, the three went over the outer wall, and once they were clear their friends pulled the rope up and hid it. They had a whole night's start, and they made for the Rhine as fast as they could go, aiming for the bridge of boats that carried the road over to Rastatt. They didn't reach it until nearly noon, far later than they'd hoped. But there they had an extraordinary stroke of luck. While they lay in a little wood watching the bridge end to see how the sentries behaved,
They saw a religious procession pass along the lane below them. A procession formed of separate groups, several hundred strong, carrying green branches and singing. The banners in front began to cross the bridge, and the sailors, cutting themselves some greenery, slipped down the bank into the lane and joined the throng, singing as well as they could and looking fervent. Few people took any notice of them. It was a gathering of several villages. And if anyone spoke, Corby answered while the others sang. They crossed the bridge with still another troop chanting behind them, and Corby went on into the town where he bought pumpernickel and dried beef. At this time they looked quite respectable, with their good blue coats stripped of all distinguishing marks. But coming back, Corby was questioned, fortunately by a very simple, easily impressed, easily deluded young conscript, from whom he learnt that three English officers were being pursued. They therefore kept strictly hidden in the woods for the next week or so, never moving until it was dark. And by the end of that time, what with foul weather, hard lying, and slipping and falling in the mud of a hundred streams, they looked like thoroughly suspicious vagrants. They had a razor, and they kept fairly clean, but it was no good. All dogs barked at them, and if by chance they passed any countryman, Corby's greeting would meet with a startled, uneasy stare. They dared not approach any village. And so the long, slow march south and east went on, far slower than they'd expected. And they lived on what they could find. Raw turnips from the fields, potatoes, green corn, a very little game. Week after week, until they became very feeble, particularly as they had rain almost all the time. They were sometimes hunted, once or twice by gamekeepers, but nearly always because they'd raided farmyards, or because patrols had heard of their presence. And Fielding spoke of their perpetual fear, the fierce, hunted expressions that soon became habitual, almost fixed, and their savage hatred not only for their pursuers, but for anyone who might possibly betray them. Once they were very near killing a couple of children who stumbled on their hiding place. He said that this hatred overflowed into their relations with one another, making their disagreements very dangerous, and, if possible, increasing the utter joylessness of the last weeks of their journey. And he spoke with feeling that Stephen would never have expected from his lowering, apparently insensitive face.
"I wonder you could stand it,"
he observed when Fielding reached the point where they found that they'd lost their way, and that after 2 days of toiling over Bear Mountain with no food at all, they looked down into a valley and saw not the Austrian post they'd expected, but the tricolour flying in French-occupied Italy. A narrow, treeless valley with a fort on a rise in the middle, and no village, no isolated farms, no herdsmen's summer chalets, and no possibility of retreat.
"As far as I was concerned,"
said Fielding, "I was buoyed up by a particular sentiment that I should have walked twice as far if my feet had held out. I believe the same applied to the others, and when I think of all the hardships they bore in vain, upon my honour I see no justice in the world. It's not to be believed that both their wives were whores."
"What happened to Mr. Corby?"
"He was killed. Murdered. We were chased by a cavalry patrol only 3 days before the end, when we were on the sea coast in sight of ships. He couldn't run, and the troopers fairly hacked him to pieces, though he was unarmed. I got into a marsh, into deep reeds and water up to here." He paused, and then in a flat voice he said, "I was the only one left. I brought them no luck. Except from the professional point of view, perhaps it would have been better if I'd stayed in Beach. And even from that point of view, in any event, I shall not hurry back to Malta for a ship." At this point, Fielding was talking almost wholly for himself. Yet even so, Stephen felt that some response was necessary. He said, "I had the honour of being introduced to Mrs. Fielding, and she was so very kind as to invite me to her musical evenings."
"Oh, yes, said Fielding. She's a great musician. Perhaps that was the trouble. I cannot make out God save the king on a penny whistle.
Captain Aubrey and Captain Cotton of the Nymph had been midshipmen together. And not even midshipmen, but youngsters. Entered on the old resolutions books as captain's servants. Squeakers, of no use to man or beast. They'd used little ceremony at the age of 12, nor had they grown much more formal with one another as they rose in rank. And now Jack, having led his friend below, was surprised to see a constrained, furtive, awkward hangdog expression on his face.
"Why, Harry, is it what ails thee? Art sick? Art vexed?"
"Oh, no," said Captain Cotton with an artificial simper. "Not at all."
"What is it, then? You look as if you've been found out keeping a false muster, or comforting the king's enemies."
"Well, to tell the truth, Jack, to tell you the honest truth, the fact of the matter is I have some damned unpleasant news for you. Charles Fielding, that was a prisoner at Verdun and then at Beach, Charles Fielding, that was at one time third of the Nymph and then second of the Volage, has escaped. We picked him up off Cape Promontore some days ago, and he's aboard us at this moment."
"Escaped, has he?" cried Jack. "Upon my word, I honour him for it. Escaped from Beach. Bless me, what a stroke. I'm most heartily glad of it. But tell me, what's your bad news?"
"Why," said Cotton, turning red and looking more embarrassed still, "I thought everybody said... it was generally supposed that you and Mrs..."
"Ah, because of that damned dog," said Jack, laughing. No, there was nothing in it. All nonsense, alas. Mere silly Valletta gossip. No, on the contrary. I should be very happy to take him back to her. We turn round tomorrow, so let him come across any time before we sail, and I'll give him the quickest passage to Malta that's to be had. I shall write him a note directly," he said, turning to his desk.
The answer to his note came over from the Nymph shortly before Stephen walked into the great cabin.
"There you are, Stephen," said Jack. "I suppose you know that Laura's husband's escaped and is aboard the Nymph."
"I do," said Stephen.
"Well, here's a damn thing," said Jack. "It seems that some goddamn fool has told him I was his wife's lover. The Cotton was here just now, and he said so. I instantly denied it, of course. And to make my denial utterly convincing, I sent over straight away, offering to carry Fielding to Valletta at once. He couldn't be there for a month, otherwise I had no time to consult you," he said, looking anxiously into Stephen's face. "But in any case, it was necessary. It was the least I could do. And it had to be done immediately. I offered him my dining cabin, which I thought pretty handsome. But here's his answer."
"You were right to do so, I'm sure," said Stephen, taking it. "And there was no call in the world to be consulting me, my dear. Sometimes you misinterpret my actions."
"No call at all, he murmured, reading, "Mr. Fielding begs to acknowledge Captain Aubrey's letter of today's date, but regrets he is unable to avail himself of the offer it contains. He hopes, however, that he may meet Captain Aubrey in Malta before any considerable time shall have passed."
"I regret it extremely," he said.
And although Jack knew him very well, he couldn't tell what he meant or on what grounds he regretted it so.
"I operated on the gentlemen this forenoon and talked with them for some time afterwards," said Stephen after a while. "And although by far the best thing would be for him to come back with us, I do not feel that persuasion would serve any useful purpose. Rather the contrary, indeed. But I may take it, may I not, that we must necessarily be the first to reach Valletta with the news of Mr. Fielding's escape?"
"Certainly. We shall have that vile tub of Babington's with us, so we shall probably not set royals or even to gallants all the way. But even so, there's nothing else sailing back from here until the next convoy."
There was a silence, each far away.
Jack had fought the odd duel in his time, but he'd disliked them then, and he disliked them even more now that it was almost always a matter of pistols, generally more deadly than the sword. They seemed to him foolish and even wicked. He hadn't the least wish to make Laura a widow, even less to do the same to Sophie. "Barge alongside, sir, if you please," said Bondon in his loud sea voice, startling the silence of the cabin. "Barge?" said Captain Aubrey, brought up all standing in his meditations. "Why, yes, Your Honour," said Bondon politely, "which you're to eat your dinner with Captain Babington aboard of Dryad in 5 minutes' time."